So one of the things I love the most about being a minister is that on occasions like this, I can see all the faces. So I know you can't quite see what I see, so you're just going to have to trust me that you're absolutely gorgeous. I just can't help but think of the ancient Hebrew blessing, "May the Lord lift their countenance." For this is my understanding of the holy. It's an understanding of how we can be singular and plural, all here, separate and yet one. And to invoke another ancient Hebrew blessing, it is a miracle, and we should be grateful that we have even been delivered and sustained to arrive at this moment. This gathering is a unique revelation. It can only be what it is. This gathering of people could only be this particular morning in Sacramento celebrating your 150th anniversary. I'm so glad to spend some of this time with you. So part of my task today is to talk to you a little bit about your history. So in our 20 minutes, we're not going to have a lot of time for detail, but I would like to hold up for you some themes I see throughout those 150 years. But before we do that, I want to speak just very briefly to how complicated it is to do Unitarian Universalist history. Good, you know already, thank gosh. Phew. I mean, as a progressive movement, it's tricky to know where we stand in relationship to our past. I often think of a beautiful line from the hymn, "Rank by Rank We Stand." In that hymn, it talks about our spiritual ancestors, and it says, what they dreamed be ours to do. It's a beautiful image and a lovely notion, and it gives me pause every time I hear it. Because frankly, I'm not entirely sure that our ancestors really did dream us. Unless as a kind of nightmare, frankly. For the fact of the matter is, our ancestors didn't envision this. Many of us hold personal identities that they would not have found comprehensible. And they would find it so strange how we are gathered today, how we sit down one next to another, Christians, atheists, humanists, Jews, Buddhists. I know I'm going to leave a whole bunch of folk out. So what then if our ancestors did not imagine us? Who or what issued the invitation to which we all responded to be here together? Well, I think it's our living tradition itself that at the root, at the radical core of our faith, there is a huge invitation. I think that invitation speaks the words of the hymn we just heard, "Break not the circle, make it wider still." And in each of our individual incarnations, as humans and as congregations, we capture a little bit of that larger faith, but we never get it exactly right. But when you look hard through our specifics, you can see that broad and wide invitation. It is the larger wisdom that we have because we do stand as a people of faith in relationship to a tradition that sustains us. But let me talk about this circle gathered here. So it touches me very much that you all officially formed in 1868. So you would have been a beacon of hope in a time of unimaginable national grief. There were 17 original families that gathered this church. Your official history talks about those families as likely having been Yankee transplants. And indeed, they speak to how the resilience that it would have taken to both live in Sacramento in the mid-19th century and also start a church must have something to do with Yankee backbone. I'm not so sure. I mean, on one hand, it's a complete truism to say that Unitarianism is a Yankee transplant. As every Unitarian Universalist historian knows, if you take the map of how it is that folks immigrated out of New England and put on top of it how Unitarian churches were formed along the frontier, they match up perfectly, point for point. And yet, I'm not sure I see here simply a New England transplant. I am thinking I see something a little more California, a little more organic, and way more farm to table. And trust me, I can discern this. I'm a Midwesterner. I can easily tell the difference of things that come from my left and things that come from my right. So where might we find this core? Well, of course, it was Thomas Starr King, the famous Reverend Thomas Starr King, who first visited here in 1860. And your official history is very shy about making any connections between his visit in 1860 and the formation of the church in 1868. But you know, I think he had more of an impact than you could even imagine. Here's how I know why. So in 1860, Thomas Starr King came here to give lectures on behalf of the Sacramento Library Association. Okay, now here's a pro tip on doing UU history. Don't follow the money, follow the library books. I am not kidding. There was more than one congregation that got their start first as a library association. Indeed, when liberal religious people were trying to decide which towns on the frontier could support a Unitarian congregation, they first tried to see if a library would fly. If the library would fly, perhaps there would be a climate for religious tolerance that could support a Unitarian congregation. So 1860, Thomas Starr King comes here and he talks on behalf of that library association. So who else was involved? And well, what happens later? Well, it's Leland Stanford who also belonged to the library association. And how did Leland Stanford come to be in Sacramento? Well, because he had been a member of Thomas Starr King's church in San Francisco, and Thomas Starr King had successfully campaigned to give him the governorship. And when Leland Stanford leaves Sacramento and goes back to San Francisco, he rejoins the First Unitarian Church there under the leadership of Horatio Stebbins, the minister who was instrumental in regathering this congregation in 1887 after it had been closed in the financial crisis in 1873. Okay, so what does this all tell me? I don't think that any of those men were directly involved in those original 17 families that started this church. But I don't think you can overestimate the influence and the support that that network would have provided. And what interests me about them is not that these are just famous men, but that they're so California. I know that Reverend Lucy preached to you about Thomas Starr King in the recent past. I'm so glad she did that. And I know she spoke about how Thomas Starr King saved California for the Union. But I just want to add a gloss to that, which is to say it's also true that California saved Thomas Starr King. Thomas Starr King's career in Boston was not going well. In some ways, he had a reputation as a brilliant man. But you know what? In Boston, he was a man without a mission. Of course, it would be in California that he finds his mission and makes his most profound impact. Thomas Starr King, like so many liberals in the late 19th century, was a great fan of the ancient Greek philosophers, and Heraclitus was one of his favorite. Heraclitus was the philosopher who said, "You can't step in the same river twice." Heraclitus also said the universe is constantly in the process of becoming. Well, California was in the process of becoming. Thomas Starr King was in the process of becoming. Unitarianism on the West Coast was in the process of becoming. It makes sense to me that these things would have aligned for Starr King and for California in the way that they did. Because guess what? Unitarianism at that moment in New England had already become. So when I read your history, I see a great deal of becoming. I see here a kind of early innovation in theological diversity and theological experiment that makes me almost wonder if you weren't trying to imagine yourself into Unitarian Universalism way before there was such a thing in 1961. So let me tell you where I find these clues to your theological innovations. So it was in 1889 that the Reverend Charles Massey gave the first sermon to this gathering at the Pythian Castle. I love that. I want a Pythian Castle. I want it desperately. Anyway, in his sermon that day, he gave a message that sounds really familiar to us as 21st century Unitarian Universalists, but it was pretty unusual for the time. In that sermon, he said, "We human beings, we respond to the cosmos with emotions of awe and wonder. And in the past, when the great prophets have spoke of their experience of awe and wonder, when Jesus spoke about it, when Buddha spoke about it, when Muhammad spoke about it, they were deemed revelations and entire religions formed around them. But," Reverend Massey said, "this faculty lies in each and every one of us, that we all have the power to take our own individual experience and distill from it eternal truth." So again, that's not surprising for us to hear today. But in 1889, that was a pretty unusual sentiment. You certainly would not have heard it in a Unitarian church in Boston. You might have heard it if you went into the Massachusetts countryside and hung out with some of the Transcendentalists who were still eschewing Sunday morning in favor of long walks and eclectic reading, but you wouldn't have found it in a church. There's another interesting clue to your experiments with theology and belief, and I find that in a place you might find unusual. You all built a fireplace in 1915. Your building on 27th Street, you had a fireplace. Did you know that signals theological innovation? It actually does. So it was unusual by the early 20th century to put the comforts of home in a church building. And we know exactly where the first buildings were, the first Unitarian congregations were, that had parlors and fireplaces and some of these trappings of a domestic environment. They were mainly in the Midwest and the West, and they were almost always in the congregations that were first ministered to by our very earliest Unitarian women ministers. Some folks call that collective the Iowa Sisterhood. Oh, and their story deserves more time than we have today. But they did the most amazing piece of theological jiu-jitsu I have ever heard of, which is in that late Victorian time, every single church was preaching about how motherhood is a special and precious ministry. So these women said, well, then the mother can be a minister. So they established these churches that had a kind of new feeling of authority around them. No longer were the congregations displaces for formal public worship. It was now a place where people could gather to spend time together. The social bonds became more important. The parlor with the fireplace became just as important as the sanctuary. And so while you were, forgive me, I'm not criticizing, a little slow to call a woman to full-time ministry, there is a clue in this past that you were very open to new powers of governance. And indeed, it's impossible to ignore reading your history how predominant the role of women has been here. 1868, you actually insisted that three of your board of trustees members be women. That's pretty remarkable. And the role of the Women's Alliance in this congregation and in Unitarian Universalism in general just cannot be overestimated. I'm so grateful to Reverend Roger, who has done so much to preserve that oral history. It's an important piece of all of our past. So just one final piece of evidence of your early theological diversity, and this is going to put us into 1929, when you all decided to take a terrible survey about what you believed. Oh, we do this as Unitarian Universalists, right? So the survey was this: tell us which of the following three options best describes your religious beliefs. One, I subscribe to the extreme liberal Unitarianism humanism. Two, I subscribe to conservative Unitarian values. Three, I'm uncommitted. Isn't that a brilliant survey? So, in response to that survey, 45 folks said that they resonated with conservative Unitarian values. Six people said that they resonated with the extreme liberal position of humanism. And 9 people, and I just want to hug each and every one of them, said that they were uncommitted. Now, that might seem like signs of a theological disagreement. And it was. But you know what? It was such a precocious theological disagreement. At various points in Unitarian and Unitarian Universalist history, we've had to have hard conversations about how humanists and Christians can be in the same space and use the same language and experience the same worship. What you may not know is how early 1929 was to be talking about that. The seminal sermon, Unitarianism and Humanism, by the Reverend John Dietrich, was only given in 1927, and the American Unitarian Association doesn't act like it's even heard of this humanist thing until the early 1930s. So I think in a way that was probably a hard thing for this congregation to navigate, but I'm impressed again that it happened for you so early. Now, this is the challenge. If what our radical core of our faith says to do is break not the circle, make it wider still, it requires both that we constantly think of new ways of doing inclusion, but it also means that from time to time we have to reinforce a sense of what it is that holds us together. And in our tradition, that is frankly our covenant. Our covenant is what the promises that we make to each other that is our glue, that says that we hold with each other in a spirit of agreement about how we are as humans as opposed to a shared belief. At different points in your history, you seem to have shied away some from the concept of covenant, wanting to make that expansive room for theological disagreement. That was probably a source of some difficulty. I'm so delighted, though, to read. I mean, clearly, your recent history has been about recovering that sense of covenant. And I can see the fruits of that in this growing and thriving community. And what a thrill it was to hear you say your covenant this morning as a part of your worship. So just one more thing about your specific history, and that is, like a lot of Western Unitarian congregations, y'all have had kind of a weird relationship with Boston. So the American Unitarian Association, for generations, they gave you a financial subsidy to help you pay for full-time ministry. I think that financial gift came with a pretty serious cost. As I said, I think you all were doing something here really different than what was happening in New England at the time. And so how odd it must have been to have Boston making decisions really for you about who should serve as your minister when they were imagining that you all were a missionary outpost of the Unitarianism that they knew. I am really convinced that this created for a long time some deep tensions in your congregation and in your DNA as an organization about ministry and what is your relationship to your professional minister, and is that person the person that you deserve? That's to say, thank gosh, you did come to a place of financial independence, and I think that has allowed you to be growing and thriving and healthy in a way that could not happen without that. Every Sunday, when I pass the plate in my congregation, I say, this is the sacrament of the free church. It is because we are financially independent that we can have a diverse community. I believe that very deeply. So, I started by talking about a grand old hymn. So I'd like to conclude by talking about another grand old hymn. It's such an oldie. I'm thinking many of you probably don't even know it. It's called It Sounds Along the Ages. Does anyone know this one? Oh, one soul, thank you. So this was one of my favorites growing up as a Unitarian Universalist. So It Sounds Along the Ages speaks about this it that arises in different times and different places. It spoke through the words of the Hebrew psalmist. It spoke through the transcendentalists in Concord. It spoke through the New Testament. It spoke through all of the great prophets. And every single time it spoke, it brought new justice and new truth. So as a young person, I loved this hymn. Then somewhere, maybe 10 years into ministry, I decided it was the worst hymn ever. It really began to bother me that this was a song with a preposition with no referent. It sounds along the ages. If we couldn't even define the it, what business did we have singing the song? What is the it? It made me crazy. But finally, I find myself coming back to liking that song because I do see an it. I see an it here. I see a glimmer of a larger faith, a larger wisdom that does come breaking through our incarnations as congregations that are always so complex and so beautiful, but you might have noticed also sometimes a little bit imperfect. But the it is always there speaking. I am so impressed with your attempts over the years, as I said, to move towards a kind of Unitarian Universalism, a place that honors personal revelation, a place that honors the place of difference. And so I see the it in who you are now, and also in who you are moving to be. I personally can't wait to see how the rest of your story unfolds, because I am sure your next reinvention of Unitarian Universalism is going to be even more awesome.